Running a call center sales team is definitely filled with challenges, but at the same time, can be very rewarding. There is no manual for how to win the call center sales game, which is why this podcast exists. As your guide, our goal is to help you overcome challenges, discover new tools, innovate where possible, and hear stories from others who have made it to the top of the call center mountain. Welcome to the Scalable Call Center Sales Podcast with your host, Jason Cutter.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome to another special episode of the Scalable Call Center Sales Podcast. So glad that you're here. This one is, I'm going to say this is going to be a fun one. It's going to be interesting, and it's probably going to be scary for call center owners and sales leaders and people who are running sales teams, because today I have Eric Troutman. He is a partner at the law firm of Squire Patton Boggs, and he is the czar of TCPAworld.com. Make sure to check out that site. I'll mention it at the end as well. So he is one of the country's prominent class action defense lawyers and is nationally recognized in Telephone Consumer Protection Act litigation, TCPA, and compliance for the call center industry. So we're going to have a lot of fun, probably scaring the crap out of everybody. Eric, welcome to the Scalable Call Center Sales Podcast.
Thanks, man. It's so good to be here, Jason. You've got a great show, and I'm really kind of happy to be on it. Thanks.
So I've known about you for years. I've followed you and read some of the stuff, not all of it, because you put out an amazing amount of content. For anyone who wants lots of valuable things, make sure to subscribe to your newsletter. That's a shameless plug on your behalf. And I had the pleasure of meeting you recently at some LeadsCon, Leads Council industry events, hearing you speak. And I was like, we definitely need to talk. And I definitely want you to come on the show. When it comes to call centers, telephone sales, one of the biggest things that companies know they should be careful of and either are or are not actively protecting themselves would be, you know, the compliance around TCPA, the TSRs, all those things. Let's start with, I guess, what you're seeing in the landscape of TCPA, maybe a little background on that and kind of what's the state of affairs with that right now.
Yeah, sure. So one of the nice things about being on your show, Jason, is I know the folks that watch this are already really smart in terms of being knowledgeable about the TCPA, right? These folks run call centers. These folks are compliant by and large because they're looking for ways to be aggressive, to drive sales, but to do it in a way where they're not going to get shut down one day, right? Like this is the long game, not the short game. So it's really cool to be able to talk to a bunch of folks that I know already know quite a bit about the law, but that's why I'm here, is to take quite a bit and make it really a lot and exactly what you need to know in order to take care of yourself in the long term. So right now, what's going on? Well, we all know about Facebook, right? We know that there was a bunch of courts that were saying essentially any piece of equipment that was dialing from a list of numbers was going to be subject to the TCPA, which would require you to have express written consent if you're making outbound calls to cell phones. That includes both B2B and B2C, right? Let's keep that in mind. That was the state of affairs pre-Facebook. Now, the Facebook decision came out April 1st. The United States Supreme Court said, now, you know, I'm not so sure about that. The statute says that you have to use a random or sequential number generator to either store or produce numbers. And we, the Supreme Court, say that that is actually a requirement of the statute since, you know, that's what the statute requires. And that was it's a pretty big change. And so now what I'm seeing is folks are kind of grappling with, well, what does that leave us? Does that really mean that as long as we're scrubbing the DNC, that we can just put random phone numbers onto our auto dialer and start calling people and cold calling them and trying to pitch our product that way? To which I say, you know, if that's your business model, yeah, kind of. Now, that comes with a bunch of asterisks and caveats because you do have to make absolutely sure that the dialer that you're using doesn't have a random or sequential number generator for any purpose, not just to create phone numbers, right? And that's what people get confused about, but for any purpose whatsoever. And so I'd say right now, what people are most grappling with, the big trend that I'm seeing is how do we take advantage of Facebook to deploy consumer outreach in a way that is a consumer-friendly way that is likely to drive sales without tarnishing our brand and without taking on too much risk, right? That's kind of like the big metaphysical question right now that I'm seeing. Second to that, right? So that's kind of piece one is how do we leverage Facebook? Piece two is directionally, I think, and it's of the same vein, is folks trying to move away from pre-recorded calls, right, which continue to be front and center in the TCPA landscape, and moving from pre-recorded calls to maybe AI text interactions, or you know, certainly one-to-one texting alerts, or of course the live calls being driven by different kinds of technology that don't trigger the TCPA. So that's kind of the big trend I'm seeing from a compliance standpoint inside the call centers. Like, this is where folks seem to be grappling with. And then, of course, in terms of litigation, you know, it's just important to keep in mind, even after Facebook, the TCPA continues to drive a ton of class actions. And these will run the gambit, right? Many of them are, in fact, pre-recorded call cases. Many are DNC cases. A lot of them are coming out of leads, right? Folks that are buying leads, making call center calls to leads, and the leads are turning out allegedly to not be valid. So that's a big risk area, something that people need to be aware of right now.
Now, when you say allegedly not or turning out to be valid, what do you mean?
I'll give you a really nice, clean example. Let's pick on our friends at LendingTree, who we know are a perfectly legitimate company, very upstanding, good company, good folks, right? I'm seeing allegations that a lead that was purchased, say, by Wells Fargo from LendingTree, right? Wells Fargo pays LendingTree X amount of dollars to get a lead from somebody who was interested, it seems, in a mortgage. And they went on to LendingTree and they said, I want to know about a mortgage, send my information to four lenders so they can contact me about a mortgage, right? Wells Fargo contacts that person. Seemingly, that's perfectly legal, perfectly valid, right? You've got express written consent. The consumer signed up for it. The call is made. Here's the problem. The consumer sues. They sue LendingTree. They sue Wells Fargo. And they say, wasn't me. I didn't do it. It was somebody else. And of course, LendingTree and Wells Fargo are going to require there to be third-party verification. There's going to be a Jornaya or a trusted form on that, right? But nonetheless, these folks are going to claim it wasn't me. And right now there's a petition in front of the FCC that we helped to bring on behalf of Assurance, asking the commission to say, hey, look, if you are receiving a web form submission, you're allowed to rely on that in good faith. But until that petition is granted, those cases are going to continue to be filed. And it's something we're seeing quite a bit of.
And so you're saying on good faith with the Jornaya or the trusted form, or just on good faith that it was generated with written consent?
Well, see, so the petition doesn't require the commission to decide what good faith means, right? Mm. We didn't want to set a standard that was, you know, not that many industry participants couldn't reach, right? So what we asked the commission to do was just say, hey, look, leave it in the hands of the jury to decide what good faith is. You don't give us a standard. We'll let the jury decide what's good faith. But what we need is actually the ability to even argue that good faith is the standard. And folks that are listening, they're kind of wondering, like, what's he saying? Understand that right now, today, if some clown goes on to LendingTree and inserts their information, and then they get a phone call from Wells Fargo, that guy can say, it wasn't me, I didn't do it. He can lie, right? And if he goes into court and convinces the jury that he didn't do it, let's say he creates an alibi for himself and has his buddy go to the zoo and he's got a receipt from the zoo and he goes into the judge and jury and says, look, I was at the zoo. Here's his receipt that proves it, right? And the jury says, I think he was at the zoo. So I don't think he went on the website that day. There's no defense. Wells Fargo and LendingTree in that scenario would have no defense. They would be found liable because you have to have the consent of the actual person who went on the website, who uses the phone. And here that person is claiming it wasn't him. So what we've asked the FCC to do is clarify, even in that situation, even where the guy says, I went to the zoo, there's still a defense where the caller is like, hey, look, we thought it was legitimate. And there was absolutely no way for us to know that it wasn't legitimate. And because we believed in good faith, that's the legal standard, in good faith, that it was real. And there was no evidence whatsoever in our possession that it wasn't real. Even though the guy claims he was at the zoo, we're still allowed to have made those phone calls, at least until we were told to stop calling. Now, you get told to stop calling and you keep calling, well, that's on you. But until that point, we've asked the FCC to clarify that you're allowed to make those calls. You're allowed to rely on web form submissions, which are really the backbone of e-commerce in this country these days.
Yeah. So, because I've heard this term a bunch, but I feel like there's not gray area to it, but there's maybe it's a clear definition, maybe it's not, express written consent. So
yeah,
when it comes to like calls, texts, emails, things like that, is that clear what that is, or is it like specific, like independent for each thing?
No, express written consent is actually one of the few things that are very, very clear in the law. And the reason why people kind of suggest it's not is because they don't want it to be clear. And I'm just going to be honest with you, right? The express written consent rule is not intuitive, right? It's not like, well, hey, the consumer knew that I was going to call them, so no big deal. No, it is an extremely ticky-tack rule. There are 9 things that have to be in an express written consent disclosure in order for it to be enforceable. 9. And a lot of those things, like mentioning auto-dialing technology or promotions or telemarketing, are things that people don't want to put in a disclosure because it will make it unlikely that people are going to click on that button because those ugly, ugly words that we hate are in there. But guess what? They have to be in there, right? That's what the FCC has said. The rule around express written consent is, I mean, in my opinion, at least, it's fairly abusive. I mean, there's just no need to go that deep in obtaining a disclosure. A consumer is smart enough to be able to say, yeah, I want a phone call, right? And that should be enough. But that's not what the law requires. And so when you hear confusion about what the law requires, it's largely just wishful thinking, right? It's people saying, do I have to do this? Do I have to do that? Can I trim it down? Can I cut it down? And sometimes, right, lawyers, particularly in-house lawyers who don't want to be standing in the way of sales, will say, yeah, I mean, probably you can do that, or it's not clear. I mean, look, as outside counsel, right, I'm divorced from all of that. I get paid to tell you the truth, right? That's my job, is to be your counsel. I got to tell you, you got to have all the language in the disclosure. And as I like to tell people, and you know this better than I do, Jason, right, that the more direct and honest you are with the consumer, the more transparent you are with the consumer, the better qualified that lead is going to be and the better experience that consumer is going to have. So to me, there's no reason to hide it. But a lot of folks don't like to have all that language in there.
Yeah, makes sense. And that does answer why, in my mind, I've heard it's very specific, but then it also is like, well, what is express written consent? And did you check all those boxes? Which mm-hmm. makes sense if you have those 9 different things. And of course, for the good actors in the industry that are making calls, that are, you know, generating or buying leads and then, you know, calling those consumers who actually want it to be called, then it's frustrating, obviously, to have all those disclosures. The trade-off is that it's the bad actors that always get to these kind of scenarios that then cause these extra disclosures, right? It's the ones that are just hammering on people.
Yeah, I mean, the FCC created the high standard, I think, to, as you were pointing out, to prevent people from slipping, right? If you've got a vague standard or a low standard, you know, people are always going to ride the line, especially the gray or black hats, right? They're going to ride the line. And so when the FCC created this high bar, it did it fully understanding that some people are going to try to slip beneath it. And I think they assumed that, oh, look, even if you slip a little bit beneath it, right, at least it's still going to be pretty good for the consumer. But don't slip beneath it, right? You'll get yourself sued. You'll get yourself into a big class action. And what I hear all the time, and it really kind of, you know, makes me sad, is my clients will come to me and they'll say, well, but Eric, everybody else is doing this, right? My competitor is doing this. Are you sure I can't do it? And I say, you can't do it, right? You know, if you're speeding down the highway, you get pulled over, you get a ticket, you're not going to get out of it by saying, well, everybody else was doing it too, right? That's not a defense legally. But what you can do, and I tell people this all the time, like if you know for a fact that your competitor is violating the law and you're doing it the right way, you can sue them. You sue them for failing to comply with the law. It's unfair competition, right? In this country, everyone has a right to compete on the same playing field. Right? If you have to follow the law, so does everybody else. And if somebody else isn't following the law, you can sue them. And guess what? You can actually recover every single dollar that they've made by cheating, right? There's no cheating allowed. There's no cheating allowed in the market. So it's just something to keep in mind. But either way, just understand it. Just because somebody else isn't following the law, that's not a justification or an excuse for you.
So I don't know if you want to make your standard disclosure about none of this being legal advice at this time, but my next question is going into, so after Facebook, with things coming up, where do you see that companies should be careful other than what you said about the random numbers, but like say for the rest of this year, whether it's at the federal level or the state level?
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, everyone knows it's not legal advice. Nobody gets legal advice from a podcast. It always makes me chuckle when people like have these long disclosures on these things. Cause I'm like, come on, you know better. but
you would hope people would know better.
One day the FCC will come out and require a 9-part disclosure for people doing webinars, but that hasn't happened yet. All right. So look, again, you know, big things to be concerned about post Facebook, right? Obviously, you have to understand what your equipment is doing. If you're making cold calls now, you've got to be scrubbing the DNC. That DNC list is more important than it's ever been before. It really is critical to understand the DNC rules and to understand that there's a lot of litigation around that. Okay. One. Two, again, directionally, pre-recorded calls are death. Move away from those. Go into triggered or human selection dialers are really the future. Stuff like the Customer Dynamics Safe Select dialer that I helped design. Really good equipment. There's a lot of, you know, those are the kind of pieces of equipment you should be thinking about moving toward, gravitating toward, in addition to the AI text engagement, which is really, I think, very powerful stuff and perfectly legal post-Facebook, right? So that's the sort of stuff you should really be kind of thinking about. And then you just have to understand, though, that if you are still using pre-recorded calls, if you are calling numbers that are on the DNC without an EBR, without that relationship or that inquiry, I mean, there's personal liability. All right. And that is still a big fight. You've got CEOs of big companies that are named and personally named, right? In this litigation, you know, people seeking $50 million against the CEO of this company or that company. And the courts allow that to happen because the TCPA is a very special little snowflake of a statute. It's different than 99% of the law out there, where if you do something for your employer, right, you can't be held liable. Your employer's liable, not you. That's crazy, right? If I do something on behalf of, you know, I work at Target and I do mess something up, I mean, I don't get sued. Target gets sued, right? Under the TCPA, no, you get sued. And that's the issue, right? The employer gets sued and the CEO and the compliance officer and the guy that made the phone call and the guy that bought the list and the guy that loaded the list, right? All of them can be personally sued. And that's what makes the statute so gross. I mean, in addition to all the other reasons why it's gross. So you got to keep that in mind. And then that's just the federal statute, right? And then the overlay now, or I guess it's the underlay, in addition to the federal statute, are the states. And we're not going to go state by state because that's boring, but Florida, my goodness, Florida, that little appendage at the bottom of this country just keeps causing trouble. And the great state of Florida has now passed a bill, hopefully you know about this, that essentially says, if you are making a marketing call to somebody in Florida and you are using an auto dialer, which by the way, is a different definition of auto dialer and includes any system that dials automatically, or any system that automatically determines the sequence of numbers to be dialed, even if they're manually dialed. Think about that, right? Click to dial systems where the system is determining the sequence of numbers to be dialed is an auto dialer under the Florida definition. If you're using any of that equipment, any of it, you have to have express written consent for a marketing call. Even if they're your existing customer, even if they've made an inquiry, even if the guy calls in and says, hey, tell me about this, but I got to run, call me back, click. You have to have express written consent or you cannot call that person back unless you're using, again, one of those human selection systems or your finger, right? That's it. That is your only defense in Florida. It's nuts. It's bonkers, but that is the law. There's a private right of action there. You can get sued, just like you can get sued in federal court. And in Florida, you're not going to be in federal court. It's a state law. So you're going to be in some like Everglades swamp courthouse getting sued for all your personal wealth. It's a terrible situation. So if you're calling consumers in Florida, take it very, very, just don't call consumers in Florida. I'm kidding. You have to. I know you do. But get the right equipment before you do.
Okay, so to clarify with this Florida one, which, you know, a lot of times it starts in one state and then it'll spread where others will adopt it. So who knows where that's going to go. But what you're saying is if I'm manually hand dialing, like I'm punching in the numbers just manually to call somebody, you're saying I can leverage an existing business relationship, but I don't have to have express written consent.
That's correct. So you've got to have, understand, in Florida, right, they've also got their own state-specific list. Okay, so you've got federal DNC, and now you've got the state. It's like the Department of Agriculture. I mean, come on, like you want me to take you seriously when I have to check the Department of Agriculture do not call list? It's like next to the Florida grocers, you know, citrus grove mandate. And oh, next to that is the telemarketing do not call list. Makes no sense at all, but that's what you have to do. So if they're not on the Florida DMC and they're not on the federal DMC and you're using either a true, you know, or like a human selection system, like Safe Select, then you can contact those individuals if they're not on those lists without express written consent. Okay.
Got it.
Otherwise, you need that express written consent.
Okay.
So you can still cold call, even in Florida, but you just have to be super, super careful about it.
Hey, it's Jason here. We'll be right back to the podcast in a moment. But first, are you ready to help your inside sales team close more deals? In my experience, there's a certain percentage of your team that acts more like order takers than sales professionals. The first step to creating a scalable sales team is to equip your reps with the right mindset and proven strategies to transform them into quota breakers. To build a team of authentic persuaders that will crush their goals, email jason@cutterconsultinggroup.com or go to www.cutterconsultinggroup.com. Now, there's another piece, and I heard you talk about this during the industry impact events that we were at, and I heard somebody else mention this as well, and you slipped it right in there in the part where you're talking about where you speak to somebody, and they say, hey, I'm busy, I'm driving, can you call me back? Or another scenario I heard that scared the crap out of me when I heard this, which is you have express written consent for this phone number, for this person. You talk to them. They say, hey, by the way, I have a bad connection. Here's a different number. Can you call me back at this number?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then that is actually really bad and opening you up, right?
Yeah. And this is exactly the sort of tricky stuff, right, that TCPA world creates. Because in both of the scenarios you just gave, guess what? You don't have express written consent, right? You don't have it. Express written consent is phone number specific. It does not attach to a human being. So if a human being gives you a different number, you don't have express written consent to call that number. Isn't that crazy? And if the person calls inbound and you talk to them, they're like, hey, I can't complete the sale right now, call me back. You don't have express written consent to call them back. So what many of my clients have done, and I think, you know, what a lot of call centers frankly struggle with is how do we operationalize a situation where we can get that express written consent? Obviously, you can understand in both of those scenarios, you can call that phone number back. You just have to do it manually, right? You have to make sure you're using your finger or you're using one of these safe systems. That's it. Okay. Those are the only two ways you can call that number back until you get express written consent. If you want to get express written consent, you can do that, right? You can do it driving them to, hey, go to the website, click, you know, go through right now, click on the button. You can say, hey, I'm going to send you a text message, right? A lot of my clients will deploy a text message. On the text message, you get the permission to send the text, one text. The text goes out and it's essentially got the express written consent disclosure in the text message. And if they respond yes, then that's going to constitute a signature, right? And that's going to give you that express written consent. And the other thing you can do is try to cabin and determine early in the phone call what information the consumer wants so that you can justify calling them back at the phone number to provide information, not sales, right? So as an example, they call in like, hey, how can we help you today? Oh, I'm interested in a mortgage. Great. What kind of a mortgage? I was interested in a 30-year fixed mortgage. Great. Are you interested in terms? Or are you moving forward? Well, probably just terms. Great. You start continuing on and you say, hey, if we get disconnected, can we call you back to discuss exactly what it is that you're looking for? Sure. Right. Now, you don't have express written consent at that point to call them back about just anything. But because they've made an inquiry regarding a specific product, something very specific, like a 30-year fixed, you can probably make a phone call back to them limited to that specific purpose to facilitate the transaction that's began. Probably. Now, here's where I will say, get legal advice there, right? Because that's kind of a tweener. You got to be real cautious and be very, very, very specific with your scripting in order for that to work. But it can work. So there's ways to kind of get over this hurdle, but just understand you cannot just take a phone number from an inbound lead and throw it on your dialer and think you're safe. No, you will get yourself killed. And people, frankly, often do get themselves in trouble doing that.
And again, I am just going to reiterate it because when I heard that, and I was just thinking of all the centers I've worked in, inbound sales, inbound customer service, whatever that looks like, where that person and what you're referring to, where this is most likely going to get people in trouble, is the professional litigators who are trying to catch companies and then go after them. and set up these traps for them. But if you're listening to this and you have a call center of any type and you're taking inbound calls, and then you can see this pattern, make sure your agents have a process and you have something in place, because it won't take many of these for it to really suck for you.
Yeah. And these, you know, these manufactured lawsuit plaintiffs, sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, but these guys, they're still out there. They're still hunting. It's gross. You know, I had the old Stoops case against Wells Fargo. That was my case. I thought I shut it down. I thought I ended manufactured lawsuit scams forever in the Stoops case, where I got the court to throw her out of court and find that you have no standing if you're trying to create a TCPA lawsuit. It was the first ruling in the country that made that finding. I was so proud of myself. And I really thought it was done. Like, this is it. Like, if Eric Trautman did one good thing in this life, he ended scam TCPA lawsuits. But no, they just keep right on coming because the defense lawyers, frankly, haven't done a good job of using my case to their advantage. And as a result, the cottage industry of suing people and setting up these lawsuits is more powerful and bigger than it's ever been before. So you just have to be careful.
So on that note, because I was going to talk about other states, but let's stay on that. So manufactured TCPA lawsuits, most everyone I know has experienced this or seen it at some point, but in case somebody hasn't, what does that mean? What does it look like? And what is your unofficial suggestion, or what do you tell your client? What path do you take people down if they get one of those?
Well, look, you know, manufactured lawsuits generally don't happen to my clients because people know who my clients are and they're not going to mess with the czar by and large. Okay. That's just my opinion, but it also seems to be practically true. So, and you also have to understand that there's a wide range of scams out there, right? So Stoops was the person that I dealt with in the case I was mentioning for Wells Fargo. And you know, whatever you think of Wells Fargo, they did a great job in that case because they could have written a check to this lady, right? So she had 86 cell phones, 86. And she obtained phone numbers from Florida. This was back in like 2016. There was still kind of the ripple effects from the Great Recession. And she knew that people in these area codes, right, where she was getting these phone numbers, were hit particularly hard, especially when it came to their mortgages. And so she would sit back with these 86 cell phones, all with Florida area codes. She lived in Pennsylvania, by the way, and would wait for the phone to ring. And when the phone rang, she'd answer and she'd say, who is this? It's, you know, so-and-so calling to collect. Okay, thank you. Click. And she'd just hang up. She wouldn't identify herself. She wouldn't do anything. She would just take a note. Then she'd collect about 100 calls. And then finally, she'd say, wrong number, click, and then hang up, right? And see what would happen, right? Many times, people would keep calling. And then she would go after them for treble damages. And she actually testified in deposition, which was the most amazing thing, that this was her business, right? She wanted the phone calls. She bought the phones for this particular purpose. She was waiting for the wrong number calls. And when she said wrong number, or she said, hey, don't call me anymore, she'd say it like kind of lightly and hope that she would just get ignored, right? Because she wanted more calls to come. And then she would say, hey, look, I told them it was the wrong number. They kept calling. So that's treble damages, right? Three times. She admitted to all of this, right? So we take this to court and we're like, Your Honor, you cannot let this happen. And the judge agreed. And the judge ruled that where somebody engages in this sort of conduct and specifically takes steps in order to create a TCPA lawsuit, that they can't sue under the statute because the statute is designed to help people who are actually being harmed by calls they don't want. And these people do not make it into that category. Using legal speak, they lack prudential standing because they're not within the zone of interest of the statute. Again, like this ruling came down in 2015. I felt very good. I felt like, man, like I've changed the world. Like, look at what I did. And what happened was, you know, many other people continue to bring lawsuits of this ilk. Maybe they don't have 86 cell phones. Maybe, you know, they only have 25 cell phones, right? But what was going wrong is the defense lawyers were taking these cases and they would go at the pleading stage, right before the deposition, before the hard work of discovery. They go to the pleading stage and they would just basically say, hey, look, judge, this guy's filed 100 other lawsuits, so therefore it's a scam. And the court would say, and frankly, quite properly, hey, look, just because he's filed a bunch of other lawsuits doesn't mean that this lawsuit isn't valid. Right? You haven't shown me anything about what happened here, what the guy did, that he actually invited or invented the lawsuit. All you're saying is he sues a lot. And, you know, in this country, you're allowed to sue a lot. not to say you should, but you know, you're allowed to. It's not as if that is by itself a bar to future suits. And so very soon there became this kind of rift in the law where if you did your homework and you did a good job and you took discovery and you put them under oath and you grilled them at deposition, you could get rid of a case. Otherwise, you're going to be stuck in cases. And unfortunately, now my case, the Big Stoops case, has become kind of the minority because of all this, frankly, bad lawyering has led to this big body of case law that says, you know, these scam calls can go on. But to answer your question directly, which is if you are a victim of one of these abusive, baloney, you know, repeat player manufactured lawsuits, you have to understand you can't just say, oh, it's, you know, so-and-so, so it's a scam, right? That's not going to get it done. Right. You have to actually do the hard work of taking a deposition, sitting the lady or the guy down under oath and grilling them and saying, you know, how many phones do you have? What happened here? Right. When you identified yourself as Joe Blow instead of by your real name in the recorded call, that was a lie. You lied. Right. And you lie all the time. And you're lying right now. Right. You got to go after these guys and you've got to get them to admit that they wanted the call. Of course they wanted the call. You file 200 lawsuits. You've got 25 cell phones. You spend half your day on the phone talking to mortgage companies. You wanted the call because you wanted to bring this lawsuit and try to make some money. And if you can develop that kind of a record, you go to a court, right? The courts get it. The courts aren't dumb, right? I mean, again, I can't emphasize enough. If you've got good counsel that's doing their job right, and oh, by the way, you have to be willing to pay for it, right? That's the other thing. You go to that Stoops case. I mean, Wells Fargo could have settled that case. They could have settled that case for a tenth of what they ended up spending to defend it, right? And that's the complicated thing for many people. And that's why these scams live on, is that so many call centers, so many callers, so many sellers and marketers, they are willing to write a small check rather than write the big check to see justice done. And that's fine. I'm not going to cast aspersions on anybody out there that's like, hey, look, man, it's dollars and cents. I'm running a business. I'm not here to, you know, to save the world. I'm just here to move on, right? I get it. That's okay. But then by the same token, don't complain when you see a bunch of manufactured lawsuit plaintiffs out there, because that's why they exist.
Yeah. What is that quote? For evil to exist in the world, it takes good people to just do nothing.
Yeah, that's all it requires, man.
That's it. So let's go back to states. So obviously Florida is the big one that's in the recent news, and we're recording this, you know, in middle of July, you know, relative to when these things are happening. Any other quirky, weird, dangerous state specific things popping up that could catch fire?
I mean, look, the states are always kind of a hodgepodge. South Carolina has got believe it or not, of all the states, South Carolina has probably got the second most robust private right of action out there. It's a big debate as to whether or not there's class actions available, though. So that's why you don't hear too much about it. But South Carolina's a dangerous state. Massachusetts, I mean, they're a mess. Just don't call Massachusetts. New York and California both have robocall bills, neither of which have meaningful private rights of action. But just understand that you might get a phone call from the AG's office out there. Indiana has, strangely enough, probably had the most active state AG in the entire nation. They're quite aggressive. So that's another state you have to be aware of. Texas, of course, has the Public Utilities Commission licensure requirement. Look, the states are a hodgepodge mess. And, you know, dnc.com has some great resources to help you stay abreast of all the states. You can always call me. At some point, I'm going to put together a matrix for every single state. But, you know, frankly, we've got billable work to do. You know, it's going to be a while, but just understand that the states also are very, very messy. So you just, but Florida is the biggest one. And I can't emphasize this enough, because there really is a very clean private right of action. And that means that people can sue you. And there was just yesterday, yeah, we're recording this on July 15, just yesterday, July 14 was the very first class action filed under that state statute. And remember, that state statute just became effective July 1. Okay, so it took a grand total of 2 weeks for the first class action to be filed. So litigation is live, and I predict you're going to see probably by the end of the year, you'll see over 1,000 filings down there. And next year, you'll probably see close to 5,000 filings. So take it very, very seriously.
Wow, that is crazy. I didn't realize that. So one of the things from your perspective, especially being in this, I'll say this industry focus for on the legal side, right? The TCPA, the compliance piece for call center related activity is that you obviously have the legal side. There's the technology side, which you've mentioned several times, of like what people could use to stay safe, what will keep them out of harm's way the most. And then also there's the fact that you're seeing operations all over the place, right? And so yours might be a compliance thing, but you're seeing marketing, you're seeing sales, you're seeing enough of it. What are you seeing that companies who are doing well this day and age on the sales side? So not so much like this TCPA compliance, but I'm just curious because you have this insight, potential insight into what people are doing well, sales related, marketing related, what's not working well, like outside of the compliance piece.
Well, look, I don't want to gore anybody's ox, okay? But I see, it's not a surprise, right? The folks that are most kind of discerning at the top of the funnel are going to see best conversion, you know, as the consumer journey kind of goes through to the sales cycle. And that shouldn't be a surprise to anybody. And that's why I say, like, you know, if you're out there buying, you know, multi-vertical leads, right, you know, co-reg stuff, and then you're wondering why you're getting sued and it's not converting, I mean, I don't want to gore anyone's ox. I don't want to, you know, say anything mean about somebody's product, but you have to be smart about what you're buying, and you have to be smart about how you're leveraging your existing tools in light of the leads that you have. But, you know, kind of setting all of that aside, I have been moved and very impressed with how responsive many of my clients have proven in terms of taking my advice in operationalizing compliance, right? Really operationalizing compliance and seeing it not ultimately hit the bottom line. I hear it all the time, right? All the time. Eric, we can't do X, we can't do Y, because it will kill conversion. It will really hurt us. We ran some beta tests, and you know, if you put the disclosure above the button, you know, we're gonna drop 3%. And you know, I hold firm and I'm like, I love you guys, but this is the law. And if you don't follow the law, then you're in trouble. And they're like, fine, they do it. And then, oh, lo and behold, it didn't hurt conversion at all. Or they actually saw, you know, a profit margin increase, right? Because they couldn't buy, you know, as many leads, they bought less leads. And all it shows, turns out that the leads that they were buying were better quality. They actually converted better and actually made more money, at least as a percentage. So, you know, to me, innovation, right, and operationalizing compliance, that's where the real genius is, too. Let me just say that, right? Like, to me, the difference between a call center operator or depending on how large your company is, right, somebody that's in charge of operations that throws up their hands in disgust and can't solve the problem and just, you know, blames legal for not allowing them to make sales on the one hand, and the call center operator that looks at it sideways and comes up with, I mean, I got to tell you, I mean, I can't tell you some stuff because, you know, it's private, confidential information that I know because I'm their lawyer. But I've seen some really cool innovations where I'm like, wow, I would have never thought of that. And you came up with that and it's perfectly legal and you run with it, big guy. And you know, lo and behold, it makes them even more competitive in the marketplace when it should have made them less competitive. So, you know, what I would urge all of you is to understand that if you run into a compliance roadblock, a compliance challenge, it's a challenge, right? This is where you put your thinking cap on. This is where you solve it, right? You do something that's legal and you get yourself good counsel. They can help you engineer to yes, and they can help you, right, to look over your shoulder and project manage. But ultimately, like, to me, it's that old phrase, right? Crisis is opportunity, right? It's like, if you are the smart gal or guy that you pretend to be, you can get around whatever roadblock is in front of you and you can think of a way to make your product even better, right? It's like, I've got these kids and they're always building these Lego towers, and because they're brothers and they love each other, but they hate each other, they always knock down each other's Lego tower. And I tell them every time, like, don't cry, don't throw a fit. Build a better Lego tower now. You've been given an opportunity to start anew and learn from what you did in the first instance and make one even better than you had it before. And that's the way I look at call centers that are very successful, and sellers and marketers, you know, just generally that are most successful are the ones that look at these roadblocks and they say, I'm going to engineer around it. And at the end of the day, I'm going to build my core operations in a compliant way that's going to drive sales and make me even more successful and in a legal way.
I love it. And the emphasis too on the fact that you can do that, be both compliant, operationally sound, and profitable, right? I see that same thing where there's a lot of companies who think it's either or. Either I can sell a lot or I can be compliant, but I can't do both.
No, it's just dead wrong. It's just dead wrong. Yeah. I mean, just, you know, trust me, that's just not true. It just isn't.
Yeah. And to me, that's really the old school sales model with the salespeople who just want to sell and just let them do whatever they want to do in order to make the bell ring and get someone to sign on the dotted line. And then that's just asking for trouble long term, right? Like the clients who get enrolled that way aren't probably going to be happy long term. Short term, it looks good on paper, but long term, it's not going to work.
Yeah, I completely agree.
All right. Well, I appreciate you being here and sharing all this. I've heard you speak other times, and it was way scarier when I heard you talk. This didn't feel as scary. Maybe it's because I've heard it over and over again. So, I'm used to it, and I know these things are important for people listening. Obviously, hopefully they got some value. I know the biggest thing for people to do is go to tcpaworld.com, and you're the czar of TCPA World. So go there. I know, again, I mentioned this in the beginning. Amazing email list to join, so much content. I'm always amazed at how much great stuff comes out. It's not like, hey, by the way, like here, check out these things. It's like, here's a breakdown of everything. Any other places to content? I know that's the main thing. Anything else going on that you want to talk about?
No, look, I mean, let me just say the TCPA world moves so quickly. And the reason that it didn't seem scary this time is because I didn't talk about the scary stuff, right? I didn't remind everybody that the TCPA is the single largest cash cow in the history of litigation in the United States. More millionaires have been made at the plaintiff's bar by suing under the TCPA than under any other statute, that there's $500 per call up to $1,500 if you violate the statute. Class actions are available, 4-year statutory look back, which means if you think about all the calls you've made over the last 4 years, you violate the statute today and get sued today, every single one of those calls could be at issue 4 years worth in one lawsuit at times 500. How many calls have you made in the last 4 years? Multiply that times 500. That is your potential exposure if you violate the statute today. Don't violate the statute. Tens of millions, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars you could be personally liable for. Personally, not just your company, you personally. It's as scary as it gets. And when you recognize that this is also a huge violation of the First Amendment, it's just a mess. And that's why, frankly, I've dedicated my life to this area of law. I just think it's such an interesting area of law. It moves so quickly. The stakes are so high. And I don't just mean the stakes from a monetary perspective. I mean, the stakes from a First Amendment freedom of speech perspective. It's an incredible area of law to be a part of. I'm honored always to be the czar. And TCPAworld.com, I created it to make sure that people were aware of how incredibly important this area of law is, how fast it moves. There is no barriers to content. You don't have to sign up for anything. You can always just go to my website completely free. I don't track you. I don't sell your data. I don't do anything. I just give you completely free content. No strings attached, like none. I tell people all the time, like I probably have the website that drives the most traffic on the planet that doesn't have a privacy policy. I don't have one because I don't need one because I don't do anything with your data. I don't do anything. So go read, enjoy. I break down every case every day to make sure that everyone's always informed. Again, this place moves at just a million miles an hour. It's the fastest area of law that there is. It just never stops moving and evolving. And again, the stakes are so high that you have to inform yourself, especially if you're in the call center space. But that's why I like I said at the start, what I like about your audience is I know you folks already know a good amount of this, right? I'm here to help you go from where you are now to completely compliant, right? And you can arm yourself with that information at tcpaworld.com. And of course, if you ever have questions, call me up. I always give people like 15 or 20 minutes for free. We just talk, see what there is to talk about. And if you ever need real legal advice, obviously I'm here for you.
I appreciate that, Eric. And thank you for dropping that scary nugget there a few minutes ago about the real fines and penalties and what that costs people. Dropping that scary one. Again, Eric, the czar of TCPA, thanks for being here and sharing with the audience.
Absolutely. Great show, Jason. Keep it up, man.
Did you get some inspirations of ways to help your call center sales team win bigger, stronger, and faster? Hope you are fired up to scale your sales operations. If you got value from this podcast, please go in and leave a rating and review. Also, make sure to forward this episode to anyone else you know in the call center space. We appreciate your support in growing the scalable call center sales podcast family. And if you have any comments, ideas, or feedback, contact us at cutterconsultinggroup.com.